For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
I'm Ruth Welsh. I'm on staff here at Xenos. I've been working here probably for the last 10 or 12 years. For student ministries at various points, for junior high, for high school. And now, for the last 5 years, the main part of my job has been overseeing some 20 student groups here in Xenos, both high school and college. We've got a couple seats over here, one right over there, two there, a couple there. So if you guys are fine spreading out, you'll be good. So I've been doing that the last 5 years. I actually came to Christ at Xenos in 1993 through the junior high ministry, and so I've actually grown up in student ministries at Xenos. I'm not from a Christian background in my family or in my home, so I just feel really blessed that I got reached at a young age, and so that's given me a particular burden for this age group, so much so that I never left student ministries. Just stayed on after I graduated college, and so I've had the pleasure of working in a high school group, and me and my husband lead a college home church as well. And I'm actually transitioning out of my role as a sphere leader overseeing these groups because my husband and I are expecting our first kid in December, which is why we took the road trip this summer, right? For those of you that were here for the talk beforehand. And so I'm just going to be talking some about reaching high school and college students today, because this has been a ministry that, even before I was on staff, that I've been in for the last 10 years in the college ministry. And in Xenos, our college and high school ministries are kind of wed together. And I've been involved in different high school groups there at different times. And I've asked my friend Rachel. This is Rachel Power. And I'll just tell you a little bit about her. She's going to tell you guys a lot about herself later. But she just graduated from high school in June and is getting ready to start her freshman year of college this fall. And she actually came into a relationship with Christ her sophomore year of high school in our high school home church. And so I had the joy and the pleasure of being in a high school home church with her. And now she's graduating and coming to my college home church, so we still get to be together. It's cool. And I wanted to ask her to come because I'm going to be talking this morning, this afternoon, this evening. I have no idea what time it is. This conference is like, whew, drinking from a fire hose. So I asked her to come with me today because I'm going to be talking about principles. I'm going to be talking about, ideas and concepts. And I think what we want to do is we want to take those and relate. How does this actually manifest personally in a student's life? How does that work? How does that happen? And that these aren't just these theoretical, ideas out there somewhere, but we're talking about changing real people's lives. And changing students' lives, I think, at this time is really important, in this time of their life, in the high school and college years. So that's what we're going to be talking about this morning, and we're definitely going to have time at the end for some discussion, some questions. And I'm pretty laid back and open to having discussion, so if you feel like something's really pressing you and you want to ask me something in the middle, you can shoot up your hand. If I ignore you, just jot it down and we'll talk about it at the end. So why don't I just say a word of prayer for us and we'll get started. Well, Lord, we're really thankful for this conference. It's just been so edifying, God, just to be reminded of the prominence of your word, the relevance that it has in our lives, and just look at the lost generation of young people in this country, and we know they need your truth, God. We know that's something that they need. And we want to be vessels to give it to them. And so show us, Lord, how we can do that. Show us, God, how we can get behind what your spirit is trying to do with the young people in high school and college. And just ask for our time here this morning. Just pray that you'd be helping me get through this material, that you'd be bringing to mind things in Rachel's life for her to share with us that really illustrate these principles. And just pray for our time of questions and discussions afterwards. Just pray that, God, you would be overseeing that time and bringing out anything that wasn't covered in the lecture. Amen. All right. So if our job is reaching high school and college students, I'm assuming that if you're here, you have some kind of interest in youth ministry of some sort, whether you're in it as a student, or if you're a worker or a leader in that, or if you have kids in this age range and or whatever, you have some kind of interest in that, then I'm really sorry to start off and just tell you some bad news to begin with. The church is losing our kids. By and large, we're going to look at some statistics here. The church in America has a lot of problems, right? We all know that. But one of the most startling is that we are losing our youth. More and more kids today, as they are getting older, are deciding that they do not want to remain in the church, that they do not want to follow God, and have lost a sense for why the gospel is relevant in their own lives. And this shouldn't come as a surprise given the first point there, the church is also failing to reach the lost young people of this generation. It's not just that we're losing our own kids, it's not like we can replace them by reaching the lost of this millennial generation. Believe it or not, we'll talk about this, Generation X is kind of a thing of the past. In fact, I am not even technically a part of Generation X. The generation that makes up most of the people in high school and college now is called Gen Y, Generation Y, or sometimes called the Millennials. And it's people that were born from 1980 anywhere to the mid to late 90s. And so that's the age group that we're talking about, and they're different than Gen X was. These are not people that have that same kind of slacker, grunge, alternative feel that maybe we saw 15 years ago with young people. Things are different now, and so we're not getting the job done. We're not reaching them. In Josh McDowell's book, The Last Christian Generation, he says, in past years, between 55% and 65% of church young people have said that the church will play a part in their lives when they leave home. Now only 33% of church youth say that. So that's a big jump, right? From 66 to 33, for only a third of the kids growing up in the church are saying this is what I'm going to do with my life. This is going to play a role when I'm out on my own. That's startling. Many have estimated that between 69% and 94% of their young people are leaving the traditional church after high school, and very few are returning. So when they get out on their own, when they're not with their parents anymore, when it comes down to what kind of man or woman do you want to be, these people are deciding God doesn't really play a role in that. The church really doesn't have a place in that. And that's bad news. And so it's not surprising when we look at research that David Kinnaman has done in his book on Christian that we're failing to reach the lost of this generation as well. He surveyed students and people from age 16 to 29, and this is what he found. He found one of the primary words this group used to describe their impression of Christians is hypocrite. According to his research, 84% of young outsiders personally know a committed Christian, but just 15% thought the lifestyles of those Christ followers were significantly different from the norm. They look at the Christians they know and they say, why would I want that? Why would I be interested in the church or in Christianity? That's not for me. And besides, those people, they talk a good talk, but their lives aren't any different. He also surveyed, the same age group, 16 to 29, what's your reaction to the word evangelical? 43% are unfamiliar with the term. And I'm not sure if that's a good or bad thing. That might be a good thing, because the ones that have heard of it, up to nearly 30% of them have a bad impression of that. Another 27% have a neutral impression. Only 1.7% thought that was a good thing. And so, We're living in a culture, our students in our churches, we're living in a culture where they are alienated from the unreached, right? They find out, that they tell their friends they're a Christian, and the immediate response is, this is a hypocrite. This person doesn't have anything unique to offer me. And probably, in a lot of cases, there's going to be a bad impression. And so this is the sad fact. And yet at the same time, we know that this time period between the ages of 13 and 20 is when this field is so rich. More people come to Christ during this time than any other time in their life. If we're going to win someone to Christ, odds are they're going to be in this age range between, high school and early college. And if we are just going to miss out on that, are we just going to stand back and let this happen and totally miss our window and end up with a post-Christian society? I mean, that's what we're headed towards. You know, you think about what happened with the nation of Israel. We could make the same mistake. You know, you think back to Judges 2, right? So Joshua, they had this great leader who led them through, you know, the conquest to take the land, the promised land God had given them. And then what happened after he died? What happened with the next generation? The book of Judges tells us, it says, after Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to his own inheritance. You know, this is the land that God had been promising them for so long, and they're there. And the people served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had seen all the great things the Lord had done for Israel. After that whole generation had been gathered to their fathers, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. So you have the one generation where the people served the Lord, right, throughout the lifetime of Joshua, the elders who outlived him. These people had seen what God had done. They had seen Yahweh act. They had had their own lives personally transformed by him. And yet, the next generation grew up, they knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Something was lost. Something was lost in that transition. Something was not passed down. Those elders failed to pass down this knowledge of this is who God is. This is what he's done for you. And we cannot make that same mistake. Right, we cannot be standing here 10 to 20 years later saying that all these statistics I have just listed off have gotten worse. And it doesn't have to be that way. Right, we know that God wants to act. He wants to draw people to himself. He looks at the youth of America just like we do and sees how broken and how hopeless it is. And he has the answer. And he's made us his ambassadors. And so we want to talk some about what we can do about this today. So here at Xenos, just going to be real clear about this and up front, we do not have all the answers. I'm not pretending that. I'm, you know, doing youth work for the last 10 years. I'm very aware of how inadequate I feel sometimes. You know, you come up with situations and you're like, I have no idea what to do about that. I'm completely clueless. You know, we do not have all the answers. But hopefully, in this discussion, you'll be able to glean some from our own experience, because we have seen the hand of God do some amazing things here. When I graduated high school back in 2000, we had 350 students in our college and high school ministries. Now, in 2010, we have 1,500. I know, it's kind of crazy. For you know, to think about, we had 150 in high school, and I graduated, and 200 in college, and just you know, over the last 10 years, to see what God has done, it's like, okay, we don't do everything right, but there must be something right going on there. And we've studied these numbers, and we believe that half of that growth is convert growth. These are people that are coming from unchurched backgrounds that did not previously have a relationship with Christ. So we're not just moving people around from one church to another. And so I'm going to share some with you about, you know, what we're trying to do, basically. And as I go through, I'm going to be stopping, and then I'm going to be interviewing Rachel here and asking her how she's seen this stuff play out in her life. So what we're really trying to do when we're talking about reaching Generation Y is that we must ground this generation of youth in God's truth while helping them get a vision for God's plan for their lives. This is what it's gonna take. It's not, and it's gotta be this two-pronged plan. You know, it's not enough for me to come in and tell these students, your life could be so much better if you follow Jesus. Things could be good, like you'll be happy if I'm not really giving them the truth of God, right? And it's not enough either for me just to, you know, dryly get up and present them with the scriptures, right? I got to show them this is how it's relevant to your life. This is what it's going to mean, and that God has a plan for your life, and he wants to use you. That's going to become very significant, too, as we understand more about how does this generation think and what do they value. So I'm going to talk about three different barriers in this workshop that kind of keep us from really accomplishing that goal. What are the barriers that we're up against? And there's plenty of barriers that we can talk about today. And maybe we can bring some of those up in the questions and comments afterwards. But I'm just going to be talking about these three. And the first one I want to talk about is the culture and the prevailing sense of cynicism that we see within young people in our culture in this generation. Paul Miller has a book called A Praying Life. It's awesome. It's written for a Christian that's interested in kind of revitalizing their own prayer life. But he has this great chapter on cynicism that has totally impacted my life. But some of his thoughts just on how cynicism in our culture, I thought, were relevant to this discussion as well. He says, cynicism begins with the wry assurance that everyone has an angle. Behind every silver lining is a cloud. The cynic is always observing, critiquing, but never engaging, loving, and hoping. We've moved from a Promethean age of great deeds to a listless, detached age. And I think this is a good description of the generation we're talking about here. Everyone has learned to be a cynic and a critic, to stand back and look and see all the problems. And there's something behind that, right? We'll talk about that. There's something, these people have been let down. They see the brokenness of the world. They see that the system doesn't work. But what they've decided is that they're going to detach themselves. And so more than ever, we live in an age of alienation. Like, I don't know when the last time any of you were on a college campus, but even though it's been a while for me, I live by there and go and get frozen yogurt down there a lot. And I was down there the other day, and people walk like this. They don't want to see who's around them. They don't want to interact with people. They got their headphones on, and they're basically just communicating, like, leave me alone, right? That's the prevailing sense, right? It's detached. And he goes on to quote a young blogger who says this, unlike our parents, we never believed in anything. Our defining characteristic is cynicism, but that's a double-edged sword. It protects you from crushing disappointment, but it paralyzes you from doing anything. And I think this is really true. I mean, we just saw all those stats about how people feel about the church, right? They're cynical. They think the church has nothing to offer me. That is some kind of other weird, strange entity that has no relevance in my life. And so once again, I'm not going to believe in anything. I'm not going to put my hope in anything except perhaps myself, right? Which will come out in the third barrier that we talk about. So they have a cynicism towards people. They don't trust people. They're looking at people's actions and how they're carrying themselves and what they're doing and deciding there's some kind of secret motivation, right? So let's say a student goes and tries and befriends someone else. They find out you're a believer. Oh, you're just trying to convert me, right? That's what it goes to immediately. Instead of like, actually, I was, just trying to build a relationship with you. There's this suspicion of people. Cynicism towards institutions. So obviously this would include the church. But there's also, they're cynical towards government. There's conspiracy theories and stuff like that. They're also, suspicious and cynical of family, of marriage. More and more people are deciding that marriage just isn't for them. It's not worth it. With the divorce rate so high, I mean, many of these students from this generation come from divorced and broken homes. So there's a cynicism, right? A kind of self-protective cynicism that they've evolved with to cope with the world around them, the broken world around them. And there's also a cynicism towards truth, right? This idea that you can't really know what's true. And so if you're going to come in and you're going to claim that you have a monopoly on the truth, well, that is just arrogant, and I know I shouldn't trust you. That's the prevailing attitude. And so as we look at this, we have to be prepared to interact with this cynicism. All right, we have to be prepared to think, this has got to be my starting point. I'm going to come in the moment they find out I'm a Christian, the moment that this, I'm teaching this to students, the moment that they find out you're a Christian, they will write you off. I mean, not that that should make you give up, but you need to know that. You need to know that you're going to be immediately clumped in to this, to this hypocrite category. The minute you invite them out to a Bible study, they're going to have in their mind this picture of something that has no relevance to their life, that they don't want any part of. The minute you start telling them about Jesus and the gospel, they're going to be like, that's great for you, but I don't really think that has relevance for me. And so we need to be aware of this prevailing attitude and detachment and alienation that we see in the culture. If we don't, we're going to have a hard time ministering to the lost around us. And so we need to understand the culture, and we need to let that understanding of the culture guide our approach. So we need to allow our students to be immersed in the culture. We need to allow them to interact, to build relationships, instead of trying to protect them from the outside world. Because, you know, as I get older, I'm less and less cool. Rachel will tell you that. Still a little cool, but not as much as I used to be. What was the person's name that I was pronouncing wrong? Rihanna. I was like, yeah, that Rihanna song. She was like, it's Rihanna. You know, things like that. It becomes clear that I'm not as good at connecting to the culture with young people at this point as she is, right? And so it's good. It's good that Rachel's in the culture. It's good that she knows about, like, what's cool and what's going on, and that she is, you know, her friends look at her and they think she's like me, right? On the surface. And then what we learn about the culture, we use as we think about how are we going to reach them. And what we're doing is we're really just following Paul's example, right, from Acts 17, when he was in Athens, and what he had to say to them when he was invited up to speak at Areopagus. He says, I observed that you were very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. What therefore you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you. And so Paul had taken, and then even later on, he goes on and quotes their own poets, right? And so what Paul has done here is he said, look, I've spent time with you people. I've walked around the city. I've seen that you guys are really spiritual. And I found that you even have an altar to an unknown God. You know, in case you maybe forgotten about some God. Well, I'm going to tell you about the God you forgot about. And what he's done is not only has he spent some time immersing himself in the culture, but by doing that, he's discerned a need that they have. Right? This altar to an unknown God reveals that the Athenians knew that there was probably something more that they didn't know about. There was some other need that they had, and he went from there, right, to proclaim the truth to them. And that's what we have to do. As we look at the cynicism in our culture, it also reveals a need, right? It shows us that these students, these young people, again, they know that things aren't the way they should be. They know that this world is messed up. And so, again, they've developed this kind of self-protective cynicism. And we're going to have to start out expecting them to be suspicious of us, expecting them to be cynical of us, and then pray that as we build in with them and show them that it can be different, and as we really, I think too, you know, thinking about them being cynical about truth, as we bring them under God's teaching, letting the, you know, this whole week about the Word of God, it changes people. You know, even the most hardened, cynical, suspicious people can have their hearts broken over God's truth, right? The Word of God is living and active. It pierces our hearts. And so this is something that we want to be thinking about. How do we do this? How does that work? So I wanted to ask Rachel a couple of questions here. The first one is, what did you think of the church and Christianity before actually coming to a Bible study? I'm just going to sit over here with you so it's not like I'm so far away.
I was raised in a Catholic household, but we didn't really go to church very often. So when thinking about the religious aspects of Christianity, I didn't really know what the gospel was. It wasn't what came to my mind when I thought about Christianity. And I think when you think about Christianity, you should think gospel, salvation. And another thing I thought about the church in general was just time-consuming and a big commitment and taking away from these experiences of life that you should have, like doing what you want, doing what feels good. And I was always really sinful about going to one of these Bible studies because I had friends that were involved with Xenos, because I was at a point in my life where I was living in the world and I liked that way, and I was afraid I was going to be judged and not welcomed and not really feel like I belong there.
Cool. All right. So before you went to a Bible study, you were like, this is probably not the place for me. Right? I don't belong at a place like that. So then you obviously did go to a Bible study. What changed your views, and why did you eventually decide to start a relationship with Christ and follow him?
What initially changed my views on the church before really knowing anything about the Bible or God or what he says was just going into my high school group and seeing that I was wrong about feeling like I shouldn't belong and wrong about feeling like I would be judged because I was welcomed with open arms and I was loved. I was asked questions that mattered, stuff that mattered, not stupid surfacey stuff. And just seeing like the love that other people had for each other was like impactful. Like these people, they cared about each other in a way that I had never really seen before. It was something different, and that is what was attractive about it.
We'll do it next time, whatever.
And then what eventually led me to a relationship with Christ is these people not only loving me, but also explaining to me like these needs that I wanted met by the things of the world could only be met by God. And they made it a way that I could understand, and people didn't give up, even though it took a while. It was like these needs that you have, that you want to get met, like you're doing these superficial worldly things, and it's not going to meet those needs. And I don't know, what God has done for me is like met all those needs, and a reason that I decided to follow him was because I wanted to be changed, and I didn't know how to do that, and God like opened a door to how that could happen.
Sweet. So what I'm hearing you say is that before you came, you were like, the church, Christianity, that's like a burden. It's like a time commitment that's going to take away from these things in my life that I think are really valuable and important. And I would be judged there.
Yeah.
And then what changed that view was actually interacting with believers your own age, mm-hmm. who weren't that way, who were accepting, who were loving, who wanted to really know you and build a relationship with you, and at the same time were willing to speak the truth and tell you, like, these things that you're pursuing in the world are not going to meet your needs and they're not going to fulfill you, and God has that answer. So that's cool. I think there are probably a lot of stories in this room that are very similar to that, and I think that's how we're going to win out with cynicism, right? Is by accepting people, meeting them where they're at, and at the same time being willing to introduce them to God's truth. That's great. All right. So, good. We'll hear more from Rachel in a bit. This is another thing I want to talk about, another barrier, the idea of a clergy-laity distinction. Clergy, right, so that would be professional church leaders, right? Or, you know, when you show up at your high school small group or your high school youth group, the people that are in charge. And laity, that would just be the rest of the students, the congregation, the members, if you will. And you have this distinction in churches a lot. A lot of pastors that run churches with small groups really try to fight this distinction. The idea that some people in the church, the leaders, the clergy, they do the ministry. They do the service. They, and then everyone else shows up and they get ministered too, right? I can show up on a Sunday morning, I expect my pastor or my youth pastor to give me good spiritual feelings, and then I'll go home for the week and I'll show up next Sunday for my weekly fix, right? Instead of everyone in the body of Christ playing a role, right? So this is especially difficult when we're doing youth ministry. A lot of times, you know, if you've done youth ministry, you found that it can oftentimes feel like glorified babysitting, right? Where the parents just want somewhere to shoo their kids while they go and do their church stuff. And we cannot view it this way because that's not biblical. We look at Ephesians 4:11-13, where Paul says it was he who gave some to be apostles, some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, and some to be pastors and teachers, to prepare God's people for works of service, so that the body of Christ may be built up until we all reach unity in faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God and become mature, attaining to the whole measure of fullness of Christ. What I think is really significant about what he's saying here is, like, look, God clearly has made some to be prophets, some to be evangelists, some to be pastors, some to be teachers. There are some people that God has put in place to be leaders in the church, including in youth work and in student work. But why has he made those people leaders? What's the point? To equip, to prepare God's people for works of service, or to equip God's people for works of service. That's what we as leaders are trying to do. We're trying to empower the people we're leading, and in this case, students, to be servants of God, so that they will go out and that they will do the ministry, so that they will learn what it's like to change their friends' lives. You know, my strategy in reaching the lost, what we do here in Xenos, is we don't have big fancy programs. We don't have really fun, you know, I mean, we do parties, we do outreach events, just like everybody does. But the main thrust of what gets these young people out is them building relationships with other students. And once again, realizing that maybe Christians aren't as bad as I thought. Or you're different from what I always thought Christians would be like. And if that's going to happen, it'd be really strange, right? If I, as, like, you know, 28 years old, just start hanging out of high school and start looking for girls in their teens and saying, hey, you want to go to the movies? Like, their parents would be, like, upset. That'd be weird. That's not going to work, right? I, as the leader, can't go and make that happen. But I can empower and I can equip the students that I work with. I can give them the tools and the resources they need so that they can do that, right? And that's what we got to be doing. And if we want our students to have a paradigm shift on this, maybe we need one first. You know, if maybe you're in a ministry where the kids show up to your group and you feel like they just are here because their parents are making them come here, or they expect us to do it all. They don't have a burden or a vision. The first place we got to start is with ourselves, right? Because if I'm looking at the students in my group and I'm thinking, they could never do evangelism on their own. They could never do this by themselves. Then they never will. Right? If that's what they're getting from me, the leader, if that's what I'm communicating to them all the time, then they're just going to keep doing what's expected of them. But if instead I'm coming to them and saying, no, you should be the one to do this. You should be the one to do this teaching. You should be the one to put together this party for our home church. You should be the one to have this conversation. I'll go with you. I'll help you. I'll support you. I'll pray with you. But you can do this. God wants to use you. You don't have to be a professional in order to make a difference in eternity, right? You don't have to have a seminary degree or anything like that. You don't have to have a college or high school diploma even. God wants to use you. This is what we want to be imparting to these students. Because if they don't engage in Christian work and they just show up at the meetings to get served because their parents are dropping them off and it's that time of the week, then God's work is not going to be relevant to them. Why would they do it? God's work is going to be boring to them. And their faith is not going to be their own. If we don't get our kids excited about how God wants to use them and the work that they can do, then, yeah, why would they continue to be a part of the church after they graduate high school? Those numbers begin to make sense, right? Because this has always been their parents' thing. And this is not something that we want to see happen. So a couple more questions for Rachel. And this time I'm going to remember to do this. Just hold it. So we'll just start with the first one there. What's convinced you that ministry matters? Or why do you think it is important to reach out to your friends? This is something that, I should say, Rachel's been really faithful with throughout high school. And even now, she's starting college.
I think
as a follower of God, I think it's my responsibility to reach out to my friends and take the opportunities that God gives me to share, like, this good news. Of course, I want to see my friends be saved and have eternal life with me, but I also want them to get to experience God's love and these deep-rooted relationships that I've got to experience through following God, through accepting Jesus Christ. And I think I realized, like, I mean, I just graduated, but in high school, I know that for me it was, like, the best timing and, like, to come to a thing like this because you're open-minded, you're looking for answers, you're looking for more. And that was another big reason I wanted to invite my friends out, is because they were going to be open to it, I think, more in high school than in college. But above all, just, like, I have this great message, and I want to be able to share that. It's like if you find this, a secret door or something that leads to anywhere you want, you're not going to not tell anyone about it. You're going to tell everyone about it. So it's kind of like that same thing.
So part of it for you then was definitely becoming convinced of how relevant this was for your own life and how much God had changed you and what he had offered you, mm-hmm. and then how could you not tell other people about
right.
that? So that kind of goes back to, like, one, us wanting to really make sure that we're doing the job with our own kids, right, and making sure they understand this is how, like, God's love and his relevance and his truth, this is how it affects your life. This is what it means for you. Cool. So then why has evangelism been hard for you, and what helps you remain faithful in sharing your faith?
I think for every high school, college student, anyone, evangelism is hard because you're scared of rejection, judgment, failure, whatever it may be. It's hard to strike up a spiritual conversation. It's hard to not feel like people are going to be like, she is so weird because this is what she believes. I think for me, too, personally, I sometimes doubt the power of God to change someone's life. And I've seen that play out in my life before, where I meet someone and I'm like, no, no way. God can never change them. And it's like me doubting him, and it's not my place to do that because they need God just as much as anyone else does. And I think what's helped me remain faithful is just like realizing that the power of God is beyond my imagination. And I mean, who am I to say, like, who God can change and who he can't change? And I think recognizing his truth, like, these people aren't rejecting me. They're rejecting this message of Christ. And even if they respond badly, I could be planting this little seed. God could be using me to plant this little seed where maybe at a bad time in their life, they'll think back to that message, and it could impact them then, could impact them 10 years later. And I don't have to know that, but just knowing that God has the power to use it. And I think, like, what is helped me remain faithful the most is just going back to the cross and what happened, and like, God did this for me, and other people should know that.
That's great. There's actually another set of questions, so I'm going to do that.
Oh.
All right, so how has viewing, we'll start with the first one, how is viewing the home church, right? So we have our small group ministry here in Zena, so even in our high school group, we invite them into home churches. How do you feel like viewing the home church as your group, right? Not just like a show up, I'm babysat by these old people. How has doing it as your group facilitated you doing outreach and you doing this evangelism?
I think realizing that, like, the leaders aren't going to do all the work, and if the leaders are going to bring out their friends, they're going to be going to their college group. So if we're going to want this Bible study, and if we want people to come and engage in spiritual conversation and love and serve each other and get into each other's lives, whatever, it's going to be us that needs to be bringing these people out, and us that needs to be sharing this message. And I think looking at my home church and what it did for me, like, I wanted to be a servant, and I wanted to give back to that. And, like, there's no other way to be a servant, no better way than to share the message of Christ with them,
yeah.
Get people involved in, like, a fellowship that's awesome and that can change your life. And, I mean, I want to see my friends know God, and so viewing the home church as my own is like, this is my responsibility. God has given me this responsibility, and why would I not want to follow through on that?
Yeah, no, that's good. I think that's important. Again, if they're just thinking that this is something my parents do, and this is where they drop me off in the meantime, and they don't have ownership of that group and of that ministry, why would they bring their friends to it? So what has helped you view the home church? Like, I know you're, like, getting ready to go into the college group, so you're kind of in a transition there. But with your time, or, I mean, you live in a ministry house. She lives with some of the other girls from our college group now. She's on her way to adulthood, totally. But, you know, thinking about your time in high school, and even a little bit of being involved in the college group now, what has helped you feel that way? How did you get to a point where you viewed it like, this is my group?
I think, like, initially it was, like, leaders' motivation to make it your own and equipping me for things that I felt inadequate for. And we have things called workers' meetings every couple months where we talk about our group as a whole and what we're lacking in, what we're doing well in, and just ways that we can grow and ways that we can be challenged. And this is more like they're not telling us, like, we are part of the conversation. We're talking about how our group can grow, and it's like we all have this role to play, and it's not just the leaders do the work and we watch. And, like, I think the workers' meetings for me were, like, really impactful in, like, this is my group and whatever, yeah. And seeing my friends come to know God in my high school group is, like, God is using me here. And it's not just because he wants to. It's because, like, this is my group, and I'm serving them, and, yeah.
No, that's cool. There's something that you said there that I thought was really good. Just that, like, you know, this is my group. Here are the leaders consulting you in these workers' meetings. And that's just one way to do it. You know, there's other opportunities, yeah, too. Like, why don't, you know, like, I knew when you were in high school, you had opportunities to teach the Bible.
Yeah.
You had opportunities to give your testimony, you know, stuff like that. But going to the students and asking, what do you think we should do about this?
Mm-hmm.
What do you guys want this meeting to be like? And giving them and seeking them out and almost kind of recruiting them to act as leaders in the group, I think has gone a long way.
Yeah, I think, like, having those opportunities, I got to teach home church 2 or 3 times, I think, and it's like I wasn't the only one that got to, but I was, like, willing and did view my group that way. So people viewing the group as your own, like, you get these cool opportunities to see God use you.
And I think when you do that, when you give students opportunities to serve and lead in that role, that has a huge impact on the other students, right? They're like me. You know, he or she's only a year or two older than me. I could do that, you know, and they get a vision for how God could use them in the group as well. So cool. Thanks. Wonderful. All right. This is going to be kind of a jostled recording, but whatever. All right. So then the final barrier that I wanted to talk about was the cosmos. And this is the Greek word for the world, right, that we see in the Bible to talk about the system of values that kind of run our culture and our world. It's not talking about the actual people in the world or the physical earth. And this is what John is talking about in 1 John 2:15 through 17. Do not love the world nor the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life is not from the Father but from the world. The world is passing away, and also its lusts, but the one who does the will of God lives forever. So, okay, if you do any kind of youth ministry, if you've worked with kids, you know, junior high school, or college, you're pretty familiar with the world system, right? And how this is a big deal. And a lot of us probably are really aware of the lusts of the flesh, right? Sex, drugs, and the rock and roll. And, you know, we are talking to the kids about this, we're talking to the students about this all the time, and I think for the most part, a lot of churches feel, you know, somewhat equipped to deal with this area of the barrier. What I wonder about is if we've really done our job with this other part, the lust of the eyes and the boastful pride of life. Do we see how this is presenting itself as a barrier with our students? About how the things of the world go far beyond just, you know, drunkenness and drugs and sex. And we need to give people God's perspective on that. I'm certainly not advocating that's not important. But if that's all we ever do, if that's all we ever equip them and prepare them for, then there's, you know, all this other stuff that Satan has going on in the world that can take them out. And so I'm going to... I think Mike plugged this book. It was either at some point last night or
yesterday during the plenary sessions. But tonight you're going to hear from one of our senior pastors here, Dennis McCallum, and he wrote a book on Satan, and he has this chapter on the world system in there. And I just thought, you know, I should just give him credit instead of pretending like I came up with it. I'm just going to read what he put. But I really like what he has to say about this in his book, Satan and His Kingdom. Because many Christians think of worldly things as prolific sins like wanton sex, drunkenness, drugs, or other kinds of moral filth. They see the pathetic victims of the world like likely laying in a gutter with a paper sack and saliva running down their unshaven chin. And this would be a worldly vision. You know, yeah, that would be worldly. That's where worldliness leads people at times. But many of these same Christians would never recognize the world system when looking at the green of Harvard University or the Sears Tower, a glossy magazine ad showing a family luxuriating in a hot tub in Tahiti, or a shiny SUV would not ring the cosmos bell in their minds. The problem is, Christians have often tended to take a slice out of the pie and identify that as the world, while accepting the rest of the pie as legitimate. But imagine yourself cutting a slice of pie out and noticing it's full of worms. You cast the piece aside, but quickly and uncritically gobble down the rest of the pie. That's what many Christians are doing. In particular, the church in the West has consistently failed to see avarice or greed and the quest for personal prestige as worldly, at least as long as they aren't taken too far. Notice how many Christian parents are worried and angry about the violence and sex in today's TV shows, how that might affect their children. And yet, isn't it interesting that many of those same parents have never thought about the influence advertising and shows exhibiting flagrant materialistic greed and glorifying wealth might have on their kids? And I think this is something we really got to think about, specifically with this Generation Y, specifically with these millennials, right? Because the world system, God says all of that is not loving me, right? And the point isn't that you can't have an education, you can't have an SUV. The point is, who's your master? Who do you serve, right? And that's what we want these kids to get. Because with this generation especially, this is the self-esteem generation. This is the generation that from the time, and I'm part of this generation, from the time they were young, they have been told, you are special, you can do whatever you want, you are unique, you need to love yourself, you are valuable, and this has been communicated to them from the time they were children. In fact, according to the book Millennial Makeover, over 9,000 books were written about self-esteem and children during the 1980s and 90s. Fewer than 500 books were written on the subject during the 70s. It's a huge leap, right? This is what our kids have been facing, you know, and me and Rachel and you know, this generation has been fed from the beginning. And basically, they've had this concept of worldly success set up as the ultimate idol. You know, you've got to be the best because you are the best. Whatever you want to do, however far you want to go, you know, you should just feel good about yourself. Protect yourself. Love yourself. Self, 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 self. And we know from the Bible where self gets you, right? The whole concept of if you lose your life, you'll gain it, is antithetical to this self-esteem movement, really. And so what we need to do is we need to critique and resist the world's approach to self-esteem. What this has done is it's resulted in a lot of insecure and ironically arrogant young people. They know that they matter. They know that they're significant, but they don't really know why, right? They're kind of confused as to what really makes them important. And so they have these inflated outer egos, and yet at their core, they're still searching for meaning. They're still searching for significance. Again, it's kind of like that altar to an unknown God. It's that unmet need of there's got to be more. You know, I know that I should matter. I know that my life should be meaningful. And the only reasons I'm told that is because I'm constantly like, you can be whatever you want. You're smart enough. You're good enough. You know, you're special. That, and you know, if we just we're just brought up thinking that if I just repeat these things to myself, they'll somehow become true. And we need to critique that, and we need to let people know like that the significance and the meaning you want will not be discovered in continuing to inflate your own ego. But rather, we need to replace that by teaching them what God says about who they really are. Right? You are significant. You are unique. But it's not just because all those coloring books told you that as a child. Right? It's because God made you. It's because He gave you His image. It's because He sent His Son to die for you. And He's given you a new identity. Spending time, I think, with students in this age range, talking about their identity in Christ, right? Ephesians 1, which Stuart Briscoe brought us through some of that yesterday morning. That was awesome. That's one of the first things I like to do. You know, Ephesians 1, Romans 5 through 8, taking them through. This is what God has given you. He's given you this new identity. He doesn't see all these problems. He doesn't see all this sin. Instead, He sees Christ. And He wants you to learn to live consistently with that identity. He says you're significant. That's what makes you significant. It's the authority of God, not the authority of some children's book, right? We also need to critique and resist what the world says about what it means to do something significant with your life. You know, it's pretty interesting to think about how, you know, a student says, I want to go and train to be an Olympic athlete. And everyone's like, that is great. Good job. Or a student says, I am going to pursue becoming a doctor. Yes. Education, medical, you know, field. That's great. But when they're like, I think I'm going to give my life to God. Oh, well, you should relax. Like, a little fanatical talking like that. I mean, if you want to be a spiritual person, that's fine. But don't go spending all your time on this Jesus stuff. Right, and of course, there's nothing wrong with being an Olympic athlete or a doctor. That's not the point. But what does our culture value? What does it applaud? It says that's what's the most important. That's what matters most. Your significance, your meaning, that's going to come out of a career. And so these kids, these students, you know, and this is what happened to me too. They go up through elementary school and they're told, oh man, you better get ready. You better get ready because middle school's the real thing. They go to middle school. They got a locker now, you know, and it's like, you guys are not going to be, you better be able to cut it in high school. In high school, it's going to be way different than this. No one's going to hold your hand in high school, right? And then they go to high school and it's like, SATs, ACTs, college applications. These colleges want the best. You have to be the best. You better get ready. And so it's like, I got to get ready for college. And then they go to college and it's like, and the workforce, you're not going to make it a minute there. If you're like this, you better. And so it's okay, getting ready for the workforce. And they go and they get a job. And it's like, if you want a good retirement, you better put in the hours here. And okay, I better do this. And then so what? So they've lived their whole life from the time they've been in elementary school so that they can retire one day. That's what their whole life has been building up towards. That's success. That's the system that the world has these students running through. It's always the next step. You've got to be the best at the next step, to be the best at the next step, be the best at the next step so that you can play golf in Florida one day. And there is nothing wrong with golf in Florida, right? That's not the issue. The issue is that we have a limited amount of time on this earth. And there's so much life for us to live in the meantime, and so many lives around us for us to impact. And this is what these students have been fed. This is what success is. And we've got to critique and resist that, and we've got to replace that by teaching them what God says is really significant. We got to tell them this is what it will mean to have a significant life. And you don't have to wait till you're 65 years old to do it. You can do it right now. And predominantly, how we try and build this vision in these students is, you know, we talked a little bit about trying to give them ownership of the groups and whatnot. But we also really try to get them to see themselves leading others for Christ. You know, imparting that vision of you could mentor or disciple another student. You could get together with someone else and, you know, just like Rachel's saying, like, my life's been changed. People have played these roles in my life. You can do that with somebody else. You could lead a home church like this one day. Something that I really like to tell the girls that I've met with is, when I meet down, start studying with them, start, you know, a mentorship, start a discipleship relationship, as I say, one day you're going to take this and you're going to teach this to somebody else. And that's what we're going for. And I tell them, you know, of all the things I've done in my life, seeing other girls like you turn around and give what God's given them to somebody else, that's what's brought me more joy than anything else. And I think you'll find that it's going to bring you that same joy. And then maybe I'll say something like, wouldn't it be crazy if one day you led a women's Bible study full of other women and other girls, you know, depending on what time you are in your life, that you've discipled or have been discipled by someone you discipled? Wouldn't that be awesome? And then I'm like, that's real. That can happen. If it can happen to me, and believe me, I don't know what I'm doing ever. Like, it can happen with you. And give them that vision. And I think this is something that we're going to have to work at cultivating with our students, right? Because while they've totally been given all this confidence, like I have, one, they're under all this pressure to succeed in the world. When they look at the things of God, a lot of times, you know, there's these competing values, these things in the world that I'm supposed to be worrying about as well. And then also they'll feel like, I'm not equipped to do that. You know, I'm not in a situation where I can do what you do. You know, you think of Paul encouraging Timothy in Ephesus, and Timothy's probably seeing the situation get out of control, and he's like, I just wish Paul was here. And he's like, you can do this, Timothy. Don't let anyone look down on you because you're young. Right? You just continue to set a good example. And I think that's a very natural response that we're going to see in our students. And we're going to have to help them work through it. So a couple more questions for Rachel here. First, what has been hard for you as you think about yourself discipling or leading down the road?
This is something that's really hard for me actually to think about. I feel like, and I'm sure everyone feels like this when they're getting ready to disciple or lead, but like very inadequate. Very scared, very unprepared. You don't know enough things about the Bible or about life in general to teach someone else about it. I'm scared of like failing at it. I'm scared about the time commitment, and I think about like competing areas in my life, like school, and I have to get good grades because otherwise my parents will be on my butt about it, and I have to work so I can pay rent and all this stuff. And so it's been something that's been really complicated for me to look at. And actually have this situation in my life right now about, I think like 8 months ago now, my friend Taylor came out to my Bible study, my high school Bible study, and discipleship was like put on the table. My discipler talked to me about talking to her about reading the Bible together, and I chose to ignore that. And I was scared, and I was like, I can't do it, so I'm just not going to, and I didn't. And like going to the next question, something that's helped me develop this vision is like what the truth says, like what God says about these lies that I'm believing. Is like, I am adequate because he makes me adequate, and like all my weaknesses is God's strength and all of this stuff. And I like look at the role that my discipler has in my life and what she's taught me about the Bible and life, and she's been my friend and my counselor, and I don't know where I would be without her. Like, without, if God hadn't used her in my life, I don't think I would be where I am right now. And it's like, I do want to do that for someone else. And just recognizing the truths that he says about me and about my adequacy. And I have another friend that's coming out right now, about a month now, and I just asked her if she wanted to read Identity Truths with me, and I'm really scared.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I knew you were going to.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we're going to talk about it more on Saturday, but I'm very nervous, but, like, just, I don't know, just looking at the truth and what it says. It's like, I can do this because God makes me adequate to do it.
So, like, I don't know, just keep it right here or something. It's cool because I think Rachel meets another girl in our group, Alyssa, studies and disciples her, and over time, it's been cool to see as you've grown in your knowledge of the Word and your relationship with Alyssa, and have, just like you were saying, have seen how that has totally changed your life, and to kind of see, you know, these other opportunities where you were, like, afraid and didn't do it, to now see this current situation with Abby, I think it's awesome, you know, like, and I think that this is what we got to do. We got to keep telling them, like, you be the one. You brought this girl out. She's coming now because of you. You should be the one to crack open the Bible with her and show her how it has relevance to her life. And then who knows, like, maybe in a few years, Abby will be at a workshop like this, you know, like, talking about how she's learning to do it with other people, too. That is basically what I had for you guys. And I thought I'd leave some time here at the end for discussion. And so if you guys have any questions for either me or Rachel here, I know there are some other students here from Xenos, and it'd be great if some of you guys just have examples maybe of how, like, you feel like you've learned to get ownership and take responsibility and stuff like that in your group. So any thoughts? Yeah, over here.
I had a question. We were born and raised Catholic, so we understand that void that can be there, and you know, going to the evangelical church now, you know, learn a lot of different things. Our sons are also, we have college and high school students in our house. They're kind of doing their youth thing, we're kind of doing our adult thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and for either one of you, how would you see an approach to come together to make that a whole,
like, cohesive kind
right,
of family
right.
thing.
I mean, how would it be the best way to approach our sons to
yeah.
kind of take that leadership role in the family now as, you know, and guide them to hold them spiritually accountable
right.
without them feeling like, oh, there's dad again writing me about
right.
now.
Right. Right. Now, again, as I think I said in the beginning, it's like, I don't have any kids. I'm working on my first one. She'll be here soon. But, yeah. This is what I think you can do. Because, I mean, there's still a relationship, you know, when I would be working with, like, a 14-year-old, where I'm viewed as up here and they're viewed as down here. And something that I really try to do to get them to think that way, and I don't know what this would, like, be like to do as a parent, is I try to ask them their advice on something going on in my life. So, like, if they're kind of totally in their, like, youth world and you guys are doing, like, adult ministry and you want to know how to, like, bring that together, maybe you could just ask your kids, like, this is what, you know, we were talking about on Sunday. What do you think about that? Or here's someone in the church that we're trying to build a relationship with. What do you think we should do? Like, what are you seeing in your ministry that could help us in our ministry? And that's always going to go over better first before you coming in and saying, here's what's going on in my ministry, and this is how it relates to you, you know? And I think, just like in student work or, you know, building relationships with students, is that, like, you know, especially when they're in this age group, they want to be treated like adults. You know, and obviously, you know, especially with high school kids, it's not like we can totally treat them like adults yet. But we should look for opportunities to do that. When we can seek out their input and show them, like, I care what you think and I'm going to take it seriously, I think that is, one, shocking to them, and it goes a long way. So that would be my advice on maybe somewhere to start. Do you have anything?
I was just going to say that I think, I mean, my parents aren't really into their faith at
very much anymore, but they do go to church every so often. But I know one thing that I feel loved by from them is when they just ask me questions about what's going on in my ministry and my life, and when I get to share, like, cool things, and even though they might not understand it, it's like, I feel really loved by intentional questions about, like, what's going on in my life and what I'm learning about. It's great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you see any difference in when you outreach your boys and girls, or any broad or you approach it
I see a lot of differences. I think something that we've seen is that we have a lot harder time actually keeping girls around than we do boys. This is by and large in the ministry as a whole. And part of that is because I think once a guy might be harder to win in the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, a guy might be a little more difficult in the beginning. But once he's in, it's like he's on a team, right? And he's staying on that team. And he's playing on that team, you know? Like, that's what I feel like I've seen. With the girls, I think they're a lot easier to win because they're so relational. And they are hungry for that, and they want that. And so we see a lot of them come in. And what's difficult with that is I think young girls are so insecure, and they are so, you know, especially by the self-esteem thing, I think is really backfired in our culture because it's a hollow self-esteem. And so I think, you know, girls in the world, I don't know, you guys probably tested this. I definitely saw this all through college. You know, I'd try and build a friendship with a girl in one of my classes, and she'd be like, well, I don't really have girls who are my friends. All my friends are guys. Right? That's what they would always say, because you cannot trust other women, right? That's how they would feel. And so I think at first they would want that, but then, you know, they get taken out very easily, more so by guys, by wanting a relationship with a guy and wanting those relational needs met. I think as they get older, it kind of goes the other way, because I think the guys have more of a tendency to throw themselves into that career, academic, like, I gotta achieve according to the world system. What we try to do, obviously, in working in high school and in college, is we just really try to get people grounded, for both guys and girls, get them grounded in the Word, and get them having healthy same-sex relationships, and get them to experience the body of Christ like that. So I don't know, does that answer your question? Yeah, this is a good question. We have home churches. So a home church is going to be co-ed. So it's going to be anywhere from, like, in college, anywhere from 20 to 40 students. And in high school, probably anywhere from, like, 15 to 30. And that's co-ed. Now, the high school groups do it differently, but most high school groups have a cell group, too, where every other week or once a month, they break up into guys and girls and have that separate meeting. In the college group, what we do is we have home church that's co-ed every week, and then we have cell groups that are every week that are separate. So they're having that intentional one-on-one time with other, or, you know, just single sex time with other girls and other guys. Because obviously when you're working in singles ministry with high school and college, the opposite sex is a distraction at times. Not surprising. Happens all the time. But something else that we do in college that I think really helps is that these students who, like Rachel, will move into a house, we call them ministry houses, and there's a lot of information about them on our website if you want to learn more about that, but where they're actually living with other, you know, she actually lives with other girls, three other girls that are in her same kind of life circumstance, situation, age, and they're all trying to follow God. And it's not just like a Christian boarding house. It's like, we want to do ministry together. We want to thrive with each other. We want to sharpen one another. And so I think that helps. I think you have to have both and. I think you're going to have a hard time getting new people out if there's not, you know, the opposite sex around. Because they'll be like, this is, you know, I don't need another night with the boys, you know, or whatever. But I think as they get more interested and want to grow, it's a lot easier to break them up and do the more intense Bible study separately. Do you have anything to add? Any other thoughts or questions? Yeah.
I was just
style type cell group thing.
Yeah.
Where when people are coming around, because we tend to only have like the really committed members of the group in our same sex groups. But lately we've been doing this invitation thing, so people have been coming around for a little while, and we'll invite them to that. And a lot of times they've been getting really pulled in by that relational vulnerability and closeness. And then they like want to commit totally, and they're really excited.
Yeah, and every group kind of is different. One thing that we, you know, this is what I've seen in my college group, is, you know, some of these, we have home church and then cell groups are the same-sex Bible studies that are separate. We have, I think, a really cool thing going on with our girls. We, like, very tight-knit, everyone really friends. I mean, people are going to meetings together, you know, two, three times a week, but they're spending, like, you know, they're in college. They spend, like, every night together. They're always going out doing stuff. And it's summertime, so it's, like, every morning there is an email, like, we're playing Frisbee in the park, Dad. You know, it's, like, don't you people have jobs? No, they don't. but, like, what's cool is, you know, it's not just, like, playing around and having fun. It's, like, people that are really connected with each other and really involved with each other. And people want that. And I think we have a responsibility when that happens. Because they'll find out about cell group, and they'll be like, well, can I come to cell group? And I'll be like, well, you know, maybe this is someone that's been coming out for a few weeks, even, who finds out about this and is loving the body of Christ and wants to come out. And we're like, well, you know, you're new. We're not trying to, like, place all these burdens on you and overwhelm you with all, you know, you just started coming to home church, like, 3-4 weeks ago. We're not trying to be like, you have to come to everything right now. We love having you around. But, you know, you got to realize that the relationships that we have with one another, they are sweet. But they're sweet because we have a relationship with God that we nurture and we tend to. And cell groups for people that want to do that. So if that's what you're into, great. We'd love to have you at cell group. But you need to decide if that's what you want to do. And it's hilarious. I feel like with that attitude, more and more girls are like, well, I'm serious about that. What is it? You know, like, I mean, they see it and they're like, tell me how to get this. I want that. And so I think more often than not, we're not even inviting people to our cell group. They are finding out it happens and wanting to come to it. And we're having to be like, that's okay, but this is who it's for. So I think if you can get a really good ethos and, you know, body life, and they see, and again, it's because they see these students are not letting these leaders run the show. They're doing it. They're a part of it. And I think that has a big impact. Cool. Yeah. Yeah. The way it works is we have, most home churches are going to have 4 leaders. On the high school group, it could be a little bit more. We like to have a larger student-to-worker ratio. And then in the cell groups, most of the time, it's going to be home church leaders. Sometimes there is someone that is a cell group leader that is not quite a home church leader yet. Because what will happen is these cell groups will grow and plant faster than the home church will. And so a lot of times someone is a cell group leader, and then when the home church is ready to plant, they'll become a home church leader.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many people are usually in
the home? I would say anywhere from like 5 to 18. So 5 is like, we just planted. 18 is like, we need to figure out how to plant right now. Right now we have 8 or 9 in our cell group. I don't know.
And they're not like closed or anything, right? Like you allow.
We don't. It's a little different in high school. In high school, yes, outreach is there. Non-Christians will show up to your cell group, and that's fine. Each college group kind of does it a little different. Like, she was just saying, like, in the past it's been invitation only, and now they're kind of opening it. For ours, we like to have a standard of, like, these are people that are committed to their walk with Christ and committed to, like, the home church. And if that's something you want to commit to, then we're really happy to have you in the group. But we're not trying to push it on people that don't want to make that commitment, you know. And more often than not, it seems like people are wanting it. Yeah, because we have like a main meeting, like a large service, and then we have the home church. So
we have like the ladies accountability groups, and those sound kind of like the cell groups, but like we close them after they start because it tends.
Oh, I got you. You mean it won't grow at one point?
Yeah, it tends to be like harder sometimes for ladies to like build that trust and to be vulnerable.
Yeah.
We close them, and I'm just trying to like get ideas.
Yeah.
And it's like we've had a couple that have like taken new people in, and that takes time to like build that relationship back.
Yeah.
Like, and it's good because it challenges the other ladies that maybe getting comfortable and things like that. But I love that you have like, you know, kind of standards for those
two. Yeah, I think it's good. I think, you know, each group when it starts need to decide, like, why does this group exist? Mm-hmm. And I think what, like, the kind of, I'm actually a part of another group that's kind of more like what you're talking about, where it's like five female leaders from different home churches. And we only meet once a month, and we do a study together. And we call that a challenge group. And we're like, because, you know, our cell groups are planting all the time. These other things are planting all the time. And we kind of wanted a group that was like, these are other mature women that we're going to be involved with, you know, and because we're in these other things, we only get together once a month. But it's cool also to have, like, you know, here's this group that's, we're not going to bring people in, we're not going to split it, it's not going to change. So I think in each case, you kind of have to decide, like, why does this church, this group exist, and what are we trying to do with it? Because both are good, you know. Cool. Yeah, Quest?
I think with high schoolers, I've seen a barrier with, like, the sentences of the high schoolers that just, they don't want to, like, reach out to them and say, oh, my gosh, it's just like, oh, gosh, like, they're changed. I'm like, what would be a good way to work against, like, this? Maybe some more with, like, the Zenos kids or something like that, but even outside of that, that's a good one as well.
With the outside Zenos kids, okay, or church kids, because I think this could apply to more people. Obviously, like, in case, like, Rachel, where she's felt like that, maybe she looks back and she's like, I didn't think God could change me. And then with the church kids, really we need to say the same thing to them. And if they think that God hasn't changed them, or they weren't really that bad, then that's what we get to talk about with them next, right? Like, and I think, too, I think we need to do some training on evangelism with our students. And I think past workshops maybe would have more information on that. But when I meet with leaders of high school groups, and they're like, we just can't get our kids to reach out. What should we do? I'm like, okay, it's normally one of a few things. One, they do not agree with God that this is important. Is it a heart issue? Let's talk to them about that. Two, they're afraid. Right? They don't want to be rejected. They're fearful. And in that case, it's an issue of them not really understanding God's role and their role. Like, I'm not saying you need to make this person a committed follower of Christ tomorrow. God knows that you can't do that. And if you get rejected, that might be the best thing in the world. I mean, if students are showing up saying, I've asked two of my friends out and no one wants to come, I'll be like, that's great. You know, like, you're doing your part. You're doing what God's asked you to do. I gave someone my testimony and they said it was dumb. Awesome! Like, you are being faithful. Like, you're doing the right thing. You know, we got to make sure they understand that. And it's like, we don't need to be afraid of that. So, okay, so they could either have a heart issue, a fear issue, or it could be a training issue, meaning, like, I have no idea how to have a conversation with someone about this. And so there's plenty of resources out there on that, on, like, this is how you get into a spiritual conversation with someone. This is the questions that you ask them. But, you know, so I think with each student, we need to go through, or, you know, group of students and say, what is this? Is this the heart issue, a fear issue, or a training issue? And then we can address it as needed. Do you have anything to say about that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, when I was talking about that, like, I got really reflect back on my own life and realized that it just took time and, like, I found that patience. Good.
Yeah.
Sorry, did you grow up a church kid, and how did your parents have an impact on your faith, and when did you make your faith your own?
My parents got divorced when I was, like, five, real young. So I, like, went to church when I was really young. And I had, like, I believed in God and Jesus and all that, but I didn't, you know, I was, like, 4 or 5 years old. So I did not go to a, for most of my life, I was not in the church family. And then I came to Zenos when I was 11. And that's when I was kind of at that age where I could really understand the gospel, and that's when I made a decision. So I don't know if my story is really, I don't know. I know there's a Zenos kid in here, right? No? Is there not one? All right. Some Zenos kid, let's answer that question. Yeah, sure. Or you, I don't care. What are you? I can't see your name tags. What's your name?
Kristen.
Oh, you're a Chooks.
Yeah, let's hear from you.
All right, so you, so let's hear the question again. Sorry, I'm just going to put you right on the spot.
Well, I'm just wondering, growing up in, you know, Sunday school or whatever, and they'd be like, so what do you learn? And I'd have to think that. And so she always was doing that, and my mom and me started learning together when I was really young. We'd go to nursing homes and stuff like that, and we'd start together and get closer that way. My dad was in my life because he struggled with things like addiction and stuff like that. So he was constantly there for me in that. But my faith wasn't really my own until about 8th grade, because I finally realized how much God has done for me. And I was just thinking about, like, purpose all the time, and, like, really realizing, like, wow, God has done so much for me. And for the longest time, I was like that, and I finally realized that I was on the same trip next to that, like, these orphans, and I was just, like, kind of half of them. And
thank you so much. Sorry to do that to you. But that's awesome. Thanks for sharing. Yeah.
Well, I remember your comment about being 20, not cooler than one. I'm definitely older. Could you recommend that if any church that would have a youth leader that definitely is not in their 40s or 50s?
No, I don't think, I mean, I think, her and I were actually talking about this yesterday. Like, a lot of our high school groups are run by college students and people in the college ministry, and I think that's great. But there are plenty of exceptions to that. Plenty of exceptions to that. I mean, the guy that leads the college ministry and oversees all of this is Dennis, who is going to preach tonight, and he is in his 50s. And there are plenty of workers. There are plenty of workers in their 40s and their late 30s and even in their 50s who do great. Yeah?
But I was just thinking that basically we are small, we do small community groups, and that what you guys are saying about how if we're having the same struggle with our fellow groups, we don't know quality. Because trust me, if younger girls are very sticky, sometimes girls take longer to
yeah.
know each other. Well, when you're married adults, it takes a long time to want to open up your problems.
Right. Yeah.
Our group's been together a year and a half, we're just starting to open up together.
Yeah.
So, we are in the same thing. I'm giving you a little foreknowledge. It's never going to end.
Right. Yeah.
Things will always keep coming up. That's the way you guys are handling it. You might get
yeah.
it. Yeah. I'm kind of putting up part of it. You don't need to
tell me. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. Okay.
On the other end of the, I don't see any of the grandparents in here right now. But maybe some of the kids could comment on what I see in communicating with my teenage grandchildren.
Okay.
And I think it's technology. They have their video games and their earphones and whatever they they don't have time to have a Bible study or even sit down and read and pray. And they're not with us all the time either. So
yeah.
The time is short. So maybe some of you have a way of suggesting how we can best communicate with our teenage grandchildren. Even the 7-year-old is now got his little machine he carries around with him to play games on, and it's hard to get him off of that. And up to this time, he's been very verbal, talking and everything, but now he likes to sit. So, I've limited the time that he can.
Yeah, good.
Or telling my brother not to have him bring it when he comes to my house, but just some suggestions how to communicate with young people who are so taken up with technology, texting. My granddaughter sends 3,000 texts.
Yeah, I believe it. So do these somebody. Yeah. I mean, maybe that there will be some other comments here, but one thing I'll say is that I think the mass phenomena of technological communication, whether it be social media like Facebook and stuff like that, email, texting, all that stuff, it's that's a desire, that's kids trying to connect. And So I think the desire for them to connect is still there. And, you know, I don't know your grandchildren know what they're like, but I know that, you know, there have been plenty of kids that have walked into meetings where it's like, we have to make them put down the game thing or whatever. And then those kids normally have maybe a harder time engaging. But I think, you know, my advice would just be patience and persistence and asking questions, I think, is the best thing. Like, and just trying to get into their world and saying, I'm interested. I'm interested in where you're coming from. Because, you know, if you want to be at a place where you can have a spiritual conversation with them or share with them, like, your thoughts on God or what he's teaching you, it's like, I think these kids feel like no one listens to them. And so listening first and then sharing, I think, is a good method. But does anyone else have any other input on that? Yeah.
I also think, like, maybe getting on the same level as them, not necessarily, like, getting a Facebook, but, like, talking on the phone with them. Excuse me. Or, like, talking about, like, same interests, because I know at my school, like, I have, like, a big burden for, like, some of my friends that are not Christians. And, like, especially this one friend, she's, like, really into music. She's in orchestra. Like, she wants to be, like, in orchestra when she gets older, but, like, be on the same level as them, like, talking about, like, music and stuff like that. I'm not, like, saying, like, totally, like, change your life, like, become a different person, not, like, who you truly are, but, like, really showing, like, you care and, like, wanting to, like, invest in, like, a specific area of their life that they really, not, like, have burned for, but, like, really enjoy, like, my friends with music, like, me taking, like, a handbell class or, like, taking choir with her or something like that, but, like, maybe just talking to, like, your grandson is kind of like about like some of the games he's being bored. Yeah, but not necessarily like what do you, video games do you like to play, but like what do you enjoy or like your other grandchildren that you can work on. So, like why, like what are some things that you like to look at, like on the computer, not to be like creepy or anything. Like, what things do you like to spend time with, like what friends, like what do you talk to them about? I don't know.
No, that's cool. That's good. And there is actually another grandmother in here. I just realized. Diana, I thought you had your hand up, right?
Well, I was just going to concur with this young woman. I used to say, I don't care how much you know till I know how much you care. And so develop the relationship, ask personal questions, like we've been told here that over and over, people are so hungry for someone to care about them. Mm. I've got 6 grandkids, and technology left me behind years ago. And so I say to kids, okay, show me what you're doing, and I make a fool of myself, and they love it. And so then I say, okay, yeah, we've done that a lot. And then I always have something in mind that's going to make them have to do something with their hands, like draw or whatever. Get them into my world.
That's great. Good advice. Well, I'm going to, okay, one more.
My daughter unloaded at me one time, she had all the problems from her mother and all this other stuff, but her mother and I are longer here. My daughter helps with both of them.
Yeah.
But once she started unloading, she had a lot of them.
Right, right. That's, yeah, how it can be. Okay.
Resource, any way that we can start to know more about your how do you run the
group? In Zenos? A great resource would be the Zenos website. You can get on there, and we don't really have any literature that, like, we printed about it, other than I know that Dennis is in the process of publishing a book on ecclesiology, on the church, and he has a whole chapter on student ministries in Zenos. So I'm sure that is going to be, I haven't talked to him about it recently. The title of the book keeps changing. I think the last I heard it was called, I can't even remember, like Activating the Passive Church or something, I forget. So he'll have a book on the church in the next year that will have a whole like section on it, and that will be the first time we've really had any literature published about it. So keep your eyes open for that. I'm just going to say a quick prayer for us, let you guys go get some lunch. Thanks so much. God, we're just really thankful that you sent your son to die as a payment for all of us, and that we can all have a relationship with you. thanks for the youth leaders and the parents in here and the grandparents in here and the love that they have for the young people that you put in their life, God. And I thank you, too, just for the students in here that are wanting to know how they can reach their friends better for you. And just really want to give glory to you that, I don't know, God, that you want to use young people like them. That gets me really excited. So, amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.